From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As Kentucky's Attorney General Daniel Cameron released grand jury evidence in the controversial indictments over Breonna Taylor's police killing, activists cited one modest victory, a set of reforms for the Louisville Police Department that could prevent future killings like that of Taylor. But now the city has to negotiate with the local police union in order to implement those changes. Police unions have long been a barrier to even the most modest of reforms in cities plagued by racist violence at the hands of law enforcement. Protecting those who beat, brutalize, and kill more than 1,000 Americans each year, the unions play a special and often untouchable role in the national debate. My guest is Arishina Emanuel, an editor at Injustice Watch. His recent article about police unions, published in collaboration with In These Times, is called The Thing About Police Unions. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, police unions are, of course, you know, in general terms, just like other unions, right? In particular, public sector unions. The point is for workers to have collective bargaining rights when negotiating things like salaries and health benefits. But how are they really quite different also from other public sector unions?
Well, I think it starts with what policing as a job itself is, and that certainly mistakes or shortcomings that other workers have on the job, a teacher, for instance, certainly they have consequences that can ripple through a community. But when you are armed and given broad latitude to use deadly force, certainly slip-ups on the job can mean death and brutality and a lot of the harm that we see that folks have been hitting the streets in mass to protest against. So I'd say it starts there with the nature of work. I think that also when you look at the political role that the police unions play, certainly they've had a lot of a big part in playing in the I guess, obstructions to reform efforts, whether we're talking federal DOJ mandated, you know, court ordered reforms, or something like what you see happening in Louisville. So, you know, I think that all roads to reform ultimately lead through police unions often, and a lot of governments have negotiated away their rights to sort of really be effective in ensuring accountability.
The you mentioned comparing to teachers' unions, when teachers who might be in unions are found to harm children in any way, they are held accountable, right? A teacher who is a member of a teachers' union who might physically hurt a child will be held accountable, will not be protected by the teachers' union on that front. But a police officer who hurts or kills not just an adult, but a child is often protected by the police union. Are there any instances that we know of where the police union, where the union leadership might say, well, in this case, we're not going to defend these actions? Or is it fairly uniform that police unions always come to the defense of even very clearly murderous police?
Well, I mean, I'm not a historian and I haven't studied every case. And I can say in Chicago, for the most part, which is where I'm based here with Injustice Watch, that I could be wrong. This isn't an exhaustive scan of my memory or brain, but I can say that I can't remember police union leaders standing up and saying, our guy was wrong, you know, that we're not gonna stand by this. I'd been told by a former city attorney that sometimes that might be the case for allegations of sexual assault or child abuse against officers, that there is less support or sympathy there. But regardless of what the offense is, you rarely will see publicly a police union leader speaking out against police and their own force, police that they represent.
The police unions have been very politically involved, right? I mean, they are quite outspoken. I want to quote John Catanzara, who's the head of the Fraternal Order of Police. So you're quite familiar with him, I'm sure, in Chicago. This was what he said in response to the narrative around the police shooting of Breonna Taylor. He referred to Illinois Governor and J.B. Pritzker and Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot. He said, they're trying to incite anger and get people riled up to make sure they show up to the polls. Police are the boogeyman. Black people are oppressed. Black people are shot and killed all the time. We need to rise up. Make sure you go to the voting booth, Catanzara said, his voice dripping with sarcasm, according to the Chicago Sun-Times. Is this the sort of thing that we hear from leaders of police unions like Catanzara?
I mean, if you were to go on Google and do a Google News search for police union president, most of the comments and things you would see popping up as it relates to racist police violence or police violence in general, it won't be any positive sentiment or anything that really gets behind the community. I mean, you might find some of those things, but I think that they are probably one of the more, their leadership has been one of the more conservative, I think, political blocks. I wouldn't say leadership in itself is a political block, because police officers, they range, you know, but the leadership is consistently in Chicago. Well, I'd say that their endorsements of Donald Trump, even amid, you know, this moment, you know, that this moment hasn't really shaken the Chicago FOP. And certainly you see other leaders speaking the same vitriol. I can't say that universally, but I can say that it's known. The leadership also tends to skew very white and conservative. And the comments that you just mentioned, I mean, certainly it's not a sign that they're on the bandwagon around any kind of accountability.
The Fraternal Order of Police, we know, is a very powerful and very outspoken police union. They're the ones who have most vehemently for decades lobbied against a fair trial for the political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. They have been, as you said, quite outspoken in their support of Trump. How do unions like the FOP interfere in the ability of cities to properly oversee police departments? You know, we see police officers engaging in egregious violence. And these days, of course, because it's caught on tape, we can all see it. We don't have to rely on what the survivors or witnesses have said. And, you know, often raises the question of, well, who's in charge? Why aren't the mayors able to rein in police departments? And it turns out it's the unions that get in the way, right?
Well, I think that you can't have this conversation without starting with public officials, elected officials, whether state or city levels, who have negotiated away their abilities to discipline officers, to ensure accountability. I think that there are state statutes that, well, I know that there are state statutes that grant police some of these powers over disciplinary processes and how folks complain, for instance, that you need a bar, a prohibition against, let's say, anonymous complaints. Folks are told to sign affidavits, which can have a chilling effect for someone who might be fearing, retaliation, or who might be even traumatized from their experience. Officers or the union would say that this is protecting their folks from frivolous complaints. But those are examples. I say that you have to kind of start with the elected officials who, in these state legislators, in these city halls, have passed laws that empower the unions. And you also have to look at, I think, the mayors and big the mayors of cities who have negotiated year after year after year. And
so
now
you say they negotiated away their rights. That's a really interesting way of putting it. So they you know, they do set the agenda. They can actually ensure that police unions don't get in the way of needed reforms when it comes to protecting people. But why do they negotiate away their rights? I mean, does it have to do with campaign contributions or political fear?
It's complicated. I think that on one hand, like I know here in Chicago, when the FOP was becoming, when they became the sole bargaining unit for rank and file officers, there was sort of, I guess, a police labor movement at a time where other public workers were unionizing as well. And there was, I think, some political winds behind them. There were also supporters in the state house. I think that the sort of law and order sentiment and the sort of pro-police sentiment is something that plays into it. I mean, no politician typically wants to be called anti-police or whatever. It's hard to run on this public safety platform in the past as people have envisioned public safety, maybe not in a vision of abolition of or restorative public safety, law enforcement. But it's something where there have been public sentiments and I think political sentiments that have laid the groundwork. I mean, that's one. You also have economic issues. Let's say you can't provide the raise that you would, that the union's demanding, but perhaps you move a little bit on a mediation process or on a disciplinary process or whatnot. So I think that there's
which of course means that they're negotiating away safety of the public when they do that.
Yeah, I wish we had a politician on with me right now. We could ask them more directly. I think that it's I wanted to bring up something you said around like, well, if a teacher harms a student, then they're held accountable. I mean, I'd say that that's not necessarily always the case, but one thing we do know is that a teacher's job is not to put their hands on a student, it's not to be use force against them, but our government, our society, we have accepted and have installed police as in the roles that they're in. And they are, you can't have that sort of role in a society without, the coercive force. The state uses them as an instrument of, they're part and parcel of the society is what I'm saying. And that is the role that we have assigned and accepted police in. I think there's some bigger picture questions about what safety means and for whom and how institutions support that idea of safety through laws, through policies, through who they hire, I think that it's such a web, It's not to say that police officers and unions don't own a massive part of that, but they've been empowered. And I think that it's really on state legislators and city halls and politicians and elected officials, and of course people, the grassroots, to really push if that is something that there's energy for. And I see a lot of energy out there for that. But in the state houses and city halls, I think that's a wrestling match that we're gonna see play out more and more as we move deeper into this moment, whatever this moment is.
It's quite amazing. The Fraternal Order of Police are also the union for Louisville Police in Kentucky. And as the changes, the supposed changes to the way in which that department carries out its work are implemented or brought to the table as part of the settlement from Breonna Taylor's family, the city basically has to negotiate with the FOP. Part of that settlement is requiring a new union contract, which is quite amazing, and has been kind of obscured by the lack of indictments around the police officers who actually killed Breonna Taylor. But the mayor of Louisville is quite tight-lipped. The negotiating between the FOP and the city is happening in secret. We have to remind ourselves as a public, this is the right to safety of the residents of Louisville that are on the table, at the negotiating table in this union discussion, right?
I think you bring up a good point about the discussions happening behind closed doors, which is also something that is statutory in a lot of places that's enshrined in law. There aren't like public, you know, we don't have the full bargaining agenda. We don't always know exactly what our elected officials are bringing to the negotiating table. I think that that transparency is part of the problem, that there's a lack of it rather. And that, yeah, these things happen behind closed doors. For instance, in Chicago, we know that the police union president has rejected a proposal from the mayor, Mayor Lori Lightfoot. But we don't know everything that was in her proposal. Some parts get leaked to the, you know, get leaked or get discussed, but we don't know. There's maybe several dozen disciplinary proposals, and we might know that anonymous complaints is something they want to, you know, they want to allow or enshrine. But I mean, what about everything else? There's a lot of other things there. So I think that that lack of transparency, again, is something that there's a lot of other structural policy changes that have to happen. You don't just make changes and override contracts just because you say you will. You know, I mean, you have to actually rewire the what enables some, you know, officers or FOP to negotiate over discipline in the way that they do, to the extent that they do. So again, it's certainly a web. It's a mess as well. But I think I'm glad that there's more awareness now and more scrutiny. But I think people are finding out when they're coming forth with solutions that it's easier said than done. The DOJ itself has had to, has been, you know, folks have been in legal battles, you know, cities have been in legal battles with FOP, with other police unions who have said that that reform would infringe on our contractual rights. So it's good on paper to say we're gonna make all these changes, but these things don't just live on paper. I mean, there's other paper those things live on as well that defines whether or not you can. For instance, in Louisville, was there something around the drug testing requirement?
Right, you know, for police officers.
Yeah, these aren't things you can just change unilaterally in most cases.
You would think that police unions would be all for drug testing because they want it for everybody else. And their political bedfellows want it for everybody else. Trump wanted it for his debate rival earlier in the week. Let's talk about also Minneapolis, right? This is a city that has been in the national spotlight around the police killing of George Floyd. And we mentioned, you know, John Catanzara, head of the FOP, but Robert Kroll, who is the other outspoken head of the police union in Minneapolis, very, very, you know, political and polarizing figure, who made some incredibly problematic statements. And in Minneapolis, you had a city council that actually voted to defund the police. Now, months later, we hear that nothing has happened on that. And in fact, members of the city council have backtracked on that. And it seems as though the police contract talks are what have gotten in the way. And around the country, calls around defunding the police. Associated Press did a study recently finding that nobody has defunded the police. There have been some police budget cuts, but those have just been in line with, you know, the loss of revenue around the pandemic, and everyone's experiencing cuts, but no actual defunding.
Well, again, easier said than done. If someone is willing to go into their state's collective bargaining laws, and a state legislator is willing to rewrite and rework that and take certain things off the table and make certain things around these disciplinary points, you know, mandatory, or rewrite what's known as police bill of rights bills that typically mirror the contracts and a lot of the protections they provide, you're not going to just say we're doing any level of reform. I mean, it will run up against the police union contract. So I think that people should acknowledge, I'm sure there are sentiments that are real, but it's an empty sentiment at the end of the day if you're not willing to put something to a vote, to rewrite a law, and then step to the negotiating table with more powers than you would have had. It takes a bit of rewiring, as I said.
Now, you write in your article, the thing about unions, that there's also an issue around the how other organized labor has its relationship with police unions, right? The AFL-CIO, which is supposed to be this federation of unions, a union of unions. How does it treat police unions? Because as we've been discussing, police unions, by the nature of the job of policing, are not the same as other unions.
Well, I mean, I think that a lot of folks on the left and progressives, no one loves an attack on labor, which is to say that police unions are unions. But I think that folks have been slow to denounce outright police unions and other bigger coalitions, federations that have police unions in their membership have also resisted calls to give them the boot. So I think that there is some sentiment, you know, good sentiment. People are saying the right things. Black Lives Matter, but they're not necessarily always getting tough on the folks who they should, which takes some structural change, like saying our membership does not allow an element of a labor that we feel is corrosive or violent or racist. And I hate to paint in broad brushes like that, but I don't know. It looks that way.
Well, I'm also wondering what your position is or whether you have any views on the idea that all of this talk about defunding the police, reforming the police, these are all, you know, steps that don't really address the fact that police are this force, you know, that is capable of violence, that keeps order in very unequal society, and that we really should be talking about envisioning a future where we abolish the police entirely.
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm a journalist, and so I feel like I'm not an opinion writer by trade, but I can say that the folks who have hit the streets, the young people, especially the young Black people who have been on the front lines of this thing, you know, pushing during these uprisings against racist oppression and police violence, I think they speak loud and clear to your question. I don't think I need to answer it. They've said enough. I think that the time for dialogue is, I mean, certainly there's more to discuss, but I think the people who are most impacted by these harmful institutions, I think they are the experts on those institutions. They know through experience, through practice, not theory. So whatever I could say, I think would pale in comparison, other than I know safety is a value that we don't talk about enough on a personal level, on a society level, in real terms. I mean, what's safe to me might not be safe to you. What's something that's safe? I don't know. It just varies. And I think that rethinking safety and community and love, really, you know, I think there's values there that I believe in. I'm not going to say what the exact prescription should be to get there. But I would say that we should be listening to those streets. There's a Dave Chappelle special not too long after the uprising started that I think he said basically the same thing. Why would I be out here telling you anything when those young people, those people are in the streets right now, and they said it. So that's my answer, if that's a real answer.
And the issue of safety is as you said, not enough talked about. We hear so much about law and order, but safety, public safety, is ostensibly the police's job, when in fact often we see that they are the biggest threats to public safety. Arashini, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article at Injustice Watch. Give out a website for the outlet.
Yes, it's injusticewatch.org, O-R-G.
That's injusticewatch.org. Thanks so much and good luck to you.
Thanks, Sonali. Take care.
My guest has been Arishina Emmanuel. He's an editor at Injustice Watch, and his recent article about police unions, published in collaboration with In These Times, is called The Thing About Police Unions. We've been discussing the role of unions in the conversation around police brutality. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.